All right, so does anybody remember kind of what was happening in the previous chapters? We're in chapter 19 today. The previous chapters, you have Abram, turns into Abraham. God promises that Abraham will be the father of all of many nations or many people, a great nation, hence changing his name. Sarah laughs at this. You know, how can I have a child if I'm so old? That kind of thing. And then God says, okay, well, we're done visiting Abraham. We're done giving him the message. We're going to go over to this nice place we heard of nearby called Sodom. And I want to see Sodom firsthand. Now, obviously, God is in heaven. He knows what's going on. But he does this thing every once in a while where he walks in the garden, Genesis, or he walks among the people to kind of, I don't know if it's to see firsthand, but kind of to say that there's no excuse, like, well, God's in heaven, like Zeus is on Olympus. He doesn't know what's going on down here among the normal people. Well, God doesn't actually have this problem. He literally walks down the streets of Sodom. So he can say firsthand, I know what kind of a city it is. So that's what he's about to do. And Abraham knows that God is going to destroy Sodom. And so last chapter at the end, Abraham bargains with God. He intercedes for Sodom. He says, if there are 40 righteous men, will you spare Sodom? And God says, yeah, if there's 40. Abraham says, well, what if there's 35? What if there's 30? What if there's 20? What if there's 10? And he bargains all the way down. And the entire time, he's very respectful to God. And he's trusting in God, but he's basically putting God, not putting God to the test, but putting God against his own word. God, you're a merciful God. God, you're a just God. You wouldn't destroy innocent people for the sake of rooting out the wicked people. So he's bargaining with God for Sodom. And then at the very end, God says, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. And the Lord went on his way. When he had finished speaking to Abraham, Abraham returned to his place. Now, spoiler alert, God does not find 10 righteous people in Sodom. Hence, what happens in this chapter. But it is interesting that Abraham decides, you know, that this is a good thing what Abraham did. This wasn't disrespectful for Abraham to say to God, God, I know that you have to punish the wicked, but would you have mercy, you know? He's basically asking God if he will have mercy on the rest. If, you know, if everybody's wicked but 10 people, would he have mercy even in that case? So God is a merciful God. And chapter 19. Okay, so remember Abraham's, is it his nephew? His relative Lot. It's kind of confusing sometimes, but I think it's his nephew. It's the son of his brother. Lot is living in Sodom. Remember when they showed up in the land? They're like, hey, we've got too many sheep and cows and stuff like that. You take what you think is good. I'll take whatever's left over. And they split up, and Abraham got this area, and Lot got this area, and Sodom was the city that was there. Chapter 19, here we go. So you had God, and you had the two angels who were accompanying God. I've had some people suggest that this is the Trinity. I mean, the language could potentially work, but also, there's nothing that specific. I mean, it mentions them as angels a few times. I'm just going to go with it. These are two angels and the pre-incarnate Christ. Okay. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, my lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way. They said, no, we will spend the night in the town square. But he pressed them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So far, what a nice story of hospitality. Everything is going to go well, I'm sure. The two angels go to Sodom. Lot is faithful. I'm not sure I assume that Lot knows that they're angels since he's bowing to the ground, but he's also being hospitable here. Verse 4, but before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. Now, this is interesting because it could have said something like, and then all the people in the area came and visited Lot's house. And you're kind of meant to assume that this is just, you know, a couple of people who were out in the street and there were other people who were minding their own business in their house. But when the Bible really emphasizes something like to the last man, it's everybody. It's every single man, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. It's a welcome committee, right? This is going to go well. Verse 5, and they called to Lot, where are the men that came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. That we may know them is that they may know them like Adam knew Eve. That's what they're demanding. Verse 6, Lot went out to the men at the entrance and shut the door after him. And he said, I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. All right, so far, Lot's doing the right thing. So far, these evil, wicked men want to assault these visitors to their town. And Lot, so far, is begging them not to. This is where it gets bad. Verse 7, and he said to them, I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. Well, this may be a weird sort of American Christian type thing, but I would think that your children are under the shelter of your roof. Like that this is, God gave them to you for protection. So, okay, whatever, Lot logic right here. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. Verse 9, but they said, stand back. And they said, this fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. Then they pressed hard against the man. They pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house. These are the angels. And struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out groping for the door. So this should be a sign that you're dealing with the divine or the miraculous. Even if you're in some pagan culture and you're trying to break into a house and some guy reaches out and all of a sudden all of you are blind, maybe stop. That might be an indicator that you are pressing your luck. But when it comes to sin, a lot of times sin overrides logic, sin overrides reason, and you really want to sin. And that's what happens here. They don't walk away. That's not the end of the story. Unfortunately, that would have been the best ending of the story so far. Verse 12, then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we are about to destroy this place, because the outcry against his people has become so great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his sons and daughters to be jesting. So this is similar to Noah trying to save people, and they're saying, oh, he's this crazy guy building a boat. He's joking. God's going to destroy the city. That's not going to happen. Everybody knows it's such a wonderful city. Verse 15, as morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away by the punishment of the city. But he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and two daughters by the hand. And the Lord being merciful to them, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. So even Lot and his family are not going to leave. And God says, all right, well, I'm going to save you, even though what you're doing right now is going to get you killed. Verse 17, and as they brought them out, one said, escape for your life, do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley, escape to the hills, lest you be swept away. And Lot said to them, oh no, my lords, behold, your servant has found favor in your sight. You have shown me great kindness in saving my life, but I cannot escape the hills, lest disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, the city is near enough to flee, and it is a little one. Let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be saved. He said to them, behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overwhelm the city which you have spoken. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the city was Zoar. Okay, so God, by force, has to remove Lot and his wife and his two daughters. The sons-in-law, the husbands of the daughter, refuse to go, and they are outside of the household. God is forcibly saving these people who otherwise would have been stubborn. Now, it's interesting, I don't want to read too much heavy theology into this, but I've heard the phrase, God is a gentleman, He never forces anybody to believe or have faith. He always allows people to choose to believe. And it's an interesting theory, and it sounds nice. But then you've got instances where God directly intervenes in somebody's life and knocks Saul off his horse, makes him blind, and converts him. Or you've got an instance here where God saves these people who are doing pretty much everything they can to make sure that they die, and God forcibly saves them anyway. Now, there is a degree in which if they are continually disobedient and they're continually wicked, at a certain point, God hands them over to the consequences of their action. You'll see this with Lot's wife and with Lot's sons-in-law. But God does actively save people who are dead in sin and trespass. People who are enemies are the people that God died on the cross for. So this is a pattern that you'll see later on. All right, verse 23. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the city and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Just one verse, that's all you get of what happened with Lot's wife. She looked back. Now, this verse out of context, you're like, oh, well, it's God's being mean. You know, he's just turning people to salt because, you know, she looked in a certain direction. No, she was specifically yearning to return to this city of sin, basically. And the consequences for that were death. Verse 27, and Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord, and he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward the land of the valley, and he looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was that when God destroyed the cities in the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew those cities in which Lot lived. Okay, again, it would be best if this was the last that we heard of Lot and his family, but unfortunately, they've got some issues. But yeah, so God destroys Sodom and Gomorrah. God saves Lot, and Abraham sees this. Abraham knows, therefore, that God did not even find 10 righteous people in the city of Sodom. Verse 30. Now Lot went up out of Zoar and lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. So he lived in a cave with his two daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, our father is old, and there is not a man on the earth to come into us after the manner of all earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve our offspring from our father. So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. He did not know when she lay down or when she arose. The next day the firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him so that we may preserve the offspring from our father. So they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay down with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The firstborn bore a son, called his name Moab. He was the father of the Moabites to this day. Yep, that's going to come into play. The younger also bore a son and named his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites to this day. Yep, that's going to come into play. So similar to the story of Ishmael and Hagar and Abraham, where Abraham says, I don't trust that God is going to give me a child by my wife Sarah, therefore I'm going to use Sarah's servant, and we're going to have a child by adultery. Abraham and Sarah did not trust God, and as a result, they had Ishmael, and Ishmael became the father of the Ishmaelites, which plagued the Israelites to this day. Lot's daughters did not trust God to take care of them. They sinned in adultery, and as a result, they bore the Moabites and the Ammonites, who the Israelites had problems with for a very, very long time. So if you're just jumping into the Bible way later on and you're seeing, you know, why is Israel fighting with these Moabites and Ammonites and Canaanites and Jebusites and like all these different ites? Like, what's the beef? Like, what's the problem? Are they just picking fights with everybody? No, it goes back to a point in history where someone did something really, really stupid. And as a result, generations down the line, many, many people suffered. So if it wasn't for Lot's daughter's sin here, they wouldn't have to deal with the Ammonites and the Moabites later on. All right, chapter 20. From there, Abraham journeyed between the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. He sojourned in Gerar. Gerar. And Abraham said to Sarah, said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." This sounds familiar. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent out and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her, so he said, "Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister,' and she herself, 'He is my brother'? In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." And God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return this man's wife, for he is a prophet, for he will pray for you, and you shall live. But do not return her. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, and all who are yours." What other time did this almost exact same thing happen? Do you remember? It would have been a couple of chapters earlier. Egypt. So Abram, not yet Abraham, Abram is going into Egypt and he says, "Oh no, Pharaoh likes women. He's going to see that my wife is beautiful and he's going to take her to be his own. I've got this cunning plan. I'm going to say that she's my sister." And she went along with the plan and Sarai at that time. She wasn't Sarah yet. Took Sarai and said, "Well, you know, just a sister, right? Well, I may as well marry her because she's not married." So he took Sarai to be his wife. That's what Pharaoh did. And then there were plagues that befell Pharaoh. And he comes up to Abraham and says, "What is going on? Why, you know, you lied to me. This is your wife. Take her back." So Abraham should have learned his lesson. Sarah should have learned her lesson that the ends don't justify the means. This is like the repeated refrain in every one of these chapters. Somebody does something bad to accomplish something good, and it's not good that they do it. Lot tries to offer up his daughters to these horrible men in the village. Lot's daughters, later on, they decide to take it upon themselves to get pregnant by their father. Abraham lies two different occasions that Sarah is actually his sister. It's just time after time, disobedience to God to try to be smarter than God, more clever than God. Like, "God, I'm going to fix the problem. I don't trust you to fix it. I have my own clever solution." It doesn't work out well. And in this case, Abimelech thankfully was preserved from the wrath of God. And God says, "Yes, basically, I'm the one who preserved you from making any moves on this woman. Give her back to Abraham or you're going to die." And Abimelech says, "Okay, oh, you got it." So Abimelech rose early in the morning, verse 8, and called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham to him, said, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" Abraham said, I did it because I thought there was no fear of God in all this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father through the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, this is the kindness you must do to me. At every place to which we come, say of me, 'He is my brother.'" Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell in it where you please." To Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you and before everyone that you are vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and healed his wife and female slaves so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So the story ends up turning out well for Abimelech. Abimelech is let's look at it this way. Sometimes people, when we were younger, younger people say it's not fair. That's not fair. How come somebody gets something and I don't? How come they get the bigger scoop of ice cream? How come they get an easier life? And then as adults, we don't really grow out of that. A lot of times we look at ourselves, it's not fair. How come God gave me, you know, crippling debt? Or how come God gave me this illness or this condition or this sickness? And the reality is that we see here with Abimelech and Abraham is that sometimes God protects stupid people. Abraham and Sarah continue to do dumb stuff, and God made him a promise. God's going to protect his dumbest sheep. He protects them. And Abimelech, through no fault of his own, starts to suffer consequences of somebody else's sin. This is true for you guys as well. You can suffer the consequences of somebody else's sin. Is it fair? Was it fair that Abraham brought this curse upon Abimelech and his servants? No, it's not fair. It wasn't nice. It wasn't good. But it's what happens. It's the natural consequences of sin. And God, thankfully, God took care of Abimelech, and God took care of these people. But it was not through Abimelech's sin that this sin came upon him, through Abimelech's sin that this curse came upon him, but through the sin of somebody else. So it's not always like a fairy tale where the good person only has good stuff happen to them, and if you do good, you get good. If you do good, good stuff happens to you. If you do bad, bad stuff happens to you. Sometimes you do bad stuff, and God protects you anyway. And sometimes you do bad stuff and other people suffer the consequences of that. And that's just the reality that we live in. Verse 22, at that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of the army, said to Abraham, God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my descendants or with my posterity. But as I have dealt kindly with you, so you deal with me and with the land which you have sojourned. And Abraham said, I will swear. When Abraham reproved Abimelech about a well of water and Abimelech's servants had seized, Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, and I have not heard of it until today. So Abraham took a sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two men made a covenant. Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock apart, and Abimelech said to Abraham, what is the meaning of these seven ewe lambs that you have set apart? He said, these are my seven ewe lambs that you will take from my hand, that this may be a witness for me that I dug this well. Therefore, the place was called Beersheba, because there both of them swore an oath. So they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, rose up and returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called thereon the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned many days in the land of the Philistines. Okay, so this is Abraham Abraham settling down. Abraham is going to spend some time here doing this. He was already old before this stuff happened. He's just going to keep getting older as other things happen in his old age. He had some trouble with Abimelech. They sorted it out. You'll note here that God isn't the only one who makes covenants. Sometimes people make covenants with each other. A covenant is a contract where a death sentence is connected to it. That's why covenants are cut, not signed. But basically, they're getting along. There's a treaty. Everything is resolved. There was some conflict, but they sorted it out. Chapter 21. The Lord visited Sarah, as he said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he promised. And Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age. At the time which God had spoken to him, Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh over me. And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. So the name Isaac means laughter. There was laughter when God made the promise to Sarah. She laughed, and then now she's saying that this is, you know, laughter of joy. And this is true, that through the descendant of Isaac, the world is saved. So it's certainly something to rejoice in. Verse 8, and the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw one of the sons of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had born to Abraham, laughing. Okay, so remember, Hagar is the servant of Sarah. Hagar is the one that Abraham has the child Ishmael with. And God has protected Ishmael, even though Sarah hates his guts and can't stand Hagar. So Sarah and Hagar... Yeah, it was her idea in the first place. Yeah. It was her idea. She told Abraham to do it. But then at some point, like it says that Hagar looked... spitefully, Hagar gave Sarah a look. And from that moment on, Sarah could not stand her anymore. And it's like, oh, this is the pettiest thing. So Sarah sends Hagar away. Sarah tells Abraham to send Hagar away to go die. And Abraham's like, yeah, okay, sure. You know, whatever you say is best. And so he does that. And then God saves Hagar and Ishmael, says, go back, go live with Abraham. I will take care of you. I'll give you many offspring. So this is again, this is the second kind of conflict. But yeah, you're right. It was Sarah's decision in the first place. It was Sarah's idea in the first place. All right, verse 10. So she said, verse 8. As the child grew and was weaned, Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. So Ishmael was laughing. I've heard some people say that the way that you can read this is that Ishmael was taunting or tormenting Isaac, picking on him. Or it could just be that he was laughing. And Sarah, this is kind of her reaction to that. Which is funny, because three verses sooner earlier, she was talking about laughter for me. Everyone will laugh over me, and now somebody's actually doing the laughing, and she's like, kill him. Like, chill, woman. Such a dysfunctional family. Verse 10, so she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of the slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac. And the thing was displeasing to Abraham on account of his son, but God said to Abraham, be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you. Through Isaac shall your offspring be named. And I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he is your offspring. That doesn't resound well to Abraham's descendants, but you'll find out about that later. This is an important promise for the next chapter to keep in mind, because God says to Abraham, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. So he has this direct promise from God that that through Isaac he will have that blessing that was promised to him. So he trusts that this is going to happen. Keep that in mind when he's willing to do the sacrifice in the next chapter. Verse 13, I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also because he is of your offspring. So Abraham rose early in the morning, took bread and a skin of water and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away. She departed and wandered into the wilderness of Beersheba. Keep in mind, anytime the Bible and the Old Testament mentions wilderness, well, New Testament too, wilderness or the sea, either of those things are places of chaos. That's where a lot of people believe that the demons lived and monsters lived. Here there be dragons. You saw that on ancient maps. That's the same concept. For a long time, if you go out far enough into the sea, you die. If you go out into the wilderness by yourself, you die. If your sheep or your child wanders off in the wilderness, they die. So anytime somebody is sent into the wilderness, it's a special thing if they're protected. The expectation is that they're going to die there. Verse 15, when the water in the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes. Then she went out and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. And she said, let me not look on the death of my child. And she sat opposite him. She lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Up, lift up the boy and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. And God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him in the land of Egypt. Verse 22. At that time, Abimelech and Phicol this is the part that I already read. Abimelech is interacting with Phicol interacting with Abraham. They have a conflict over whose well was whose well, property's property. So they sort it out. And Isaac was actually born at this time. This time I'm reading through it. Now we get into chapter 22. Assuming we have enough time, we do. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here am I. And he said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go into the land of Moriah. All right, that's brutal. Saying not just, oh, take the kid, but saying, take your son, your only son, by the way, your only begotten son, is what it translates to, the one you love, by the way, and go kill him. So God could have said this a different way, but he says it this way on purpose. Now, later on in the Bible, we hear that this is how Jesus is talked about. The Father takes his only begotten son, monogenes, something like, I think monogenes is the Greek word for it. The only begotten son, the son that you love, and sacrifice him. So this language is specifically being used to Isaac, and you absolutely should connect it to Christ. So human sacrifice was never a part of the Abrahamic faith, the Christian religion, God of the Old Testament. This was never a part. This is a unique instance where God shows up to Abraham. Abraham had communicated with God multiple times. This isn't like God shows up to you one day and you're like, oh, I've never talked to God before. He's telling me to go and kill my son, therefore I should do it. That's not what's happening here. Abraham knew God for 100 years at this point. He was like, this is like your best friend that you trust intimately coming over to you and saying, hey, I really needed you to do this thing. I know it sounds crazy, but have I ever led you wrong? So Abraham is in a unique situation. Nobody else has ever commanded to sacrifice their own child. So this is going to point forward to the sacrifice of Christ. He says, go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place which God had told him. Verse 4, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw a place from afar. Is it a coincidence that this is the third day image coming in? I don't think so. The third day is connected to the crucifixion and the resurrection. It's entirely appropriate that you make this connection. When he looks up, a lot of times the phrase lifting up your eyes, looking up like that, is often used as praise, lifted up his eyes. In this case, he's seeing a mountain from afar. Abraham said to his young man, stay here with the donkey, and I and the boy will go there and worship and come again to you. Notice he was commanded to sacrifice Isaac, and he says, Isaac and I will come back. And this is later on, I think in Galatians, or no, it's Hebrews, I think. If it's Galatians, it's Paul. If it's Hebrews, it's whoever wrote Hebrews. Talks about the faith of Abraham, that he believes that even if Abraham dies, God would raise, or even if Isaac dies, God would raise him from the dead. So Abraham was given a promise connected to Isaac. Abraham believes that one way or another, Isaac will survive, or Isaac will be brought back. So this is what he tells the young man. He says, you know, Isaac is coming back with me. All right. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come back again to you. Verse 6, and Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife, so they went both of them together. Again, if you want to make this connection to the son of promise walking up the mountain carrying the wood of his own sacrifice on his back, this is exactly what Christ did with the cross and the crucifixion. Please make that connection. Verse 7, and Isaac said to his father, Abraham, my father. And he said, here am I, my son. He said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself a lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So they went, both of them together. And Abraham is absolutely right, both in the case of this one instance where it's the ram, but also in the case of later on that the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world, is provided directly by God the Father. So Abraham has faith. Later on in James chapter 2, you'll see this reference. Abraham believed and it was counted to him as righteousness. This is a righteous faith that Abraham does, and he acts out that faith. Verse 9, when they came to the place which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand, took his knife to slaughter his son, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here am I. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, the Lord will provide. And it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided. So I've seen people try to figure out exactly what mountain this is. And there's a very compelling case that this is Golgotha. That there's a couple of kind of mountain peaks. It's not just like one triangle shaped mountain and they go to the top. But on top of Mount Moriah, that the place where Abraham was going to sacrifice his son, I think they built... I'm trying to remember because I get these mixed up. They built the temple over one of them, and the other one is Golgotha, which is walking distance from the temple. So you connect the sacrifice. Also, another connection here: the ram is caught in the thicket. There's neat little paintings that you can find where the ram's head is encircled by thorns. And this is, again, a call forward to Christ, who has the crown of thorns. So again, you can absolutely make that connection. On the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided. And it was provided. And that's where Christ was crucified. And the angel of the Lord came to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and you have not withheld your son, your only son." He keeps saying this phrase. "I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and the sand on the seashore, and your offspring shall possess the gate of its enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men. They rose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. Now after these things, it was told to Abraham, "Behold, Micah has also borne children to your brother Nahor. Nahor, Uz his firstborn, Buz his brother, Kemuel, the father of Aran, Chesed, Hazo, Pildash, Jidlaf, and Bethuel. Bethuel fathered Rebekah. These eight Micah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. Moreover, his concubine, whose name was Reumah, bore Tibah, Gimah, Tahash, and Makkah." And we will end there at the end of chapter 22. We can do chapter 23 next week, barring some great controversy. But with Abraham's sacrifice, it's not called the sacrifice of Isaac. It's often called the binding of Isaac, because that's what happened. Isaac was bound. Isaac was placed on the altar. Isaac was going to be sacrificed, but the sacrifice was never completed. The sacrifice is completed ultimately with Christ on the cross. And there's a thousand connections you can make between the binding of Isaac, which God withheld, or God protected Abraham from killing his son, and instead offered up his own son in that place. So there's a bunch of connections. If you want to understand the crucifixion of Christ, a way to understand it even better is to understand the binding of Isaac and the similarities and the differences. With that, let's please close with the doxology.